D.B. Cooper, won't you please come by? We're looking for you high and low. Cause leaving ain't polite in the middle of the night. D.B. Cooper, where did you go?
Today marks 50 years since notorious skyjacker D.B. Cooper jumped from the back of a 727 over southwest Washington and straight into history. Our resident historian Felix Bonnell is here with a preview of the anniversary special that he'll be hosting tonight at 6 o'clock on Cairo Radio. Felix is brought to us by Lake Washington Windows and Doors.
Morning, Dave. I think I need bifocals. I can't read the computer screen and see you all at the same time. It's been a while.
Know how it is.
So the big show's tonight during the highly rated fourth hour of Tom and Curly, which we're preempting. It's called Cooper 5-0. It's a fact-based deep dive into all the aspects of the case we can cover in a 60-minute broadcast, along with news and traffic and weather, of course. Now, the basics are that a man calling himself Dan Cooper hijacked a Portland to Seattle Northwest Airlines 727, Flight 305. He said he had a bomb in his briefcase, demanded $200,000 and four parachutes. He was given those things in Seattle and released the passengers and all but one stewardess. Plane took off again, headed south at low altitude and low speed, and somewhere over southwest Washington, Cooper jumped off the rear stairs of the jet. Despite a massive search, he was never identified and never seen again. The name D.B. Cooper was a mistake. It was actually Dan Cooper, but the D.B. part stuck. Now, I got help from a bunch of people with research for this. I went to Portland Airport, SeaTac, went down to where the aerial store is, where they used to hold that big annual party for Cooper's caper. And then I listened to old media coverage. So I have a few elements I'd like to share this morning, and some of which I just couldn't fit into the show tonight. First off, as far as I can tell, there's only one published photo of the hijacking in action. I have a copy of it in a frame there for you right there. It's Northwest Airlines 727 parked at SeaTac, far from the terminal, on the evening of November 24th, 1971. The photo was taken with a large format camera and a telephoto lens by now-retired Seattle Times photographer Bruce McKim.
I got a call from a desk saying, get out to the airport. Something's going on. We don't know what it is. I got there around, 5:30 or 6. Set up my 4x5 on a tripod and just hung out. And it was dark. And the airplane's parked over by the west side of the runway, shot a few frames, and then just stood by. And the picture that was used was while they were waiting for the ransom and the parachutes to come back.
And it's a really eerie photo because it's just a plane sitting there by itself. Now, most of the evidence is in FBI hands or is just gone. Like the 727 was scrapped a long time ago, for instance. D.B. Cooper's clip-on JCPenney tie is on display at FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. But one of the two parachutes that Cooper was given, but that he didn't use, you know, he took two with him and left two behind, one of those is stored away in the archives at the Washington State Historical Society in Tacoma. I went and got a closer look last week. The lead curator is Gwen Whiting.
This particular object is a military-style backpack-type parachute. It has what they call a quick-fit harness manufactured by the Pioneer Parachute Company. It's kind of a khaki canvas parachute. It has five silver buttons on the top. It has a harness on the back that's kind of a gray-green. But in terms of things that Cooper actually touched and handled and are material evidence of the skyjacking, which was really, you know, it really impacted American history and honestly the history of and how we travel by air today, this is really it.
Yeah, and it was actually pretty cool to see that parachute in person. I mean, it's weird. This is a crime we're talking about. Of course, nobody got hurt. People were terrified, of course. But it was weird to see that thing in person. It was kind of cool. Now, FBI was the lead agency on the Cooper case, and they followed thousands of leads over the many decades they were working on it. But they officially retired the case back in 2016, figuring too much time had passed for Cooper, or whatever his real name was, to be apprehended and prosecuted. One of the last FBI people to devote serious time and resources to finding D.B. Cooper is a guy named Special Agent Larry Carr. Now, thanks to our new news director, Charlie Harger, I got an exclusive, the only TV or radio interview that Agent Carr did for the 50th anniversary. We had a long conversation, covered many aspects of the investigation. I'll feature a big chunk about that tonight. But he had a fairly big clue about Cooper's background based on which of the four parachutes he chose for the jump from the plane.
For his main chute, he chose an NB-6 bailout rig. So it's a Navy backpack 6. It's used for pilots ejecting from an airplane. It has no steerability. It has a high rate of descent, and it has an instant opening. So there's no sleeve inside on the parachute to delay the opening. So there was a lot of shock that would have gone through that, especially at 200 miles an hour. But he also had his choice of a sport chute of the day that was steerable, had a sleeve to soften the opening, and it had a much slower rate of descent. But he chose the worst parachute for the job he was facing.
Which is funny. Agent Carr says Cooper knew just enough to be dangerous to himself. Now, I also spoke with Bill Curtis. You might know him as the announcer on NPR's Wait,
yes.
Wait, Don't Tell Me. Yeah, 50 years ago, he was a CBS bureau guy in Los Angeles. He went to Reno where the jet landed after it left Seattle and after Cooper jumped. I asked Bill Curtis about the mythological aspects of the case. You know, is there something about the Northwest? Is there something about Portland or Seattle? Is D.B. Cooper just another version of our love for weird stuff like UFOs and Bigfoot?
I would buy any of those theories. And any one has as much credibility as the other. But there's something else about the Northwest. Like, it's a kind of a mystery. It's the mystery of having a place where, you know, you can't really walk across it because it's wilderness. And that means no one lives there. No one goes there.
Yeah.
Only the mountain men who still may exist and want to live. And wild animals and bears and wild mooses.
Yeah, I don't know about the wild moose. Everything else I bought, though. I told Bill he has a great voice and asked if he ever considered a job in broadcasting.
What did he tell you?
Yeah. I also asked him to record a little promo for me, which I'd like to indulge myself with here.
This is Bill Curtis inviting you to tune in to KIRO November 24th, 6 p.m. for the full story on D.B. Cooper. Felix will enlighten you.
That's the reason you did this feature. You just wanted to get
the whole project was worth it for that alone.
His voice
exactly.
On your answering machine.
Now, we're also going to hear tonight from passenger Larry Feingold, who shared his memories of being aboard the flight. We'll have some guests joining me live, too. Greg Gilbert, who was the Times photographer in the terminal when the passengers were released. He's going to be in studio with me, actually. Mm-hmm. And then by phone, we're going to have D.B. Cooper expert Eric Euless. He's the guy who's been digging along the Columbia this year. And we're going to have the kid, he's a grown-up now, who actually found the money back in 1980, live tonight on the show.
Wow.
So it should be a power-packed, you know, not as good as a regular Tom and Curly Hour 4,
mm-hmm.
but worth listening to just the same. So anyway, it's been a fun project to work on. So.
And if D.B. is out there, this would be a perfect time for him to phone in.
Yeah, and in his 90s, he's probably in our demo, Dave. I bet she's listening.
That's what I'm... Well, maybe in Curly's demo. Felix Bunnell, all his features are at MyNorthwest.com, and the special is at 6 o'clock tonight right here. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
6:47, Seattle's Morning News. The King County Sheriff's Office is about to see some big changes, and it starts with a new interim sheriff. Let's go live to KIRO Radio's Hannah Scott. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. Yes, we got this announcement yesterday from County Executive Dow Constantine. Just to remind everybody, last year, I believe it was, the King County voters voted on several charter amendments, three in total, I believe, that are going to bring all of this change to the sheriff's office. First and foremost, making the sheriff's position an appointed position rather than an elected position for the first time in nearly 30 years. And that means that when her term ends, Sheriff Betsy Jo Hanknett will be done. That will happen December 31st, essentially. So January 1st, we now know who was going to be the interim sheriff. While they look for a permanent candidate in a national search, the interim sheriff will be the current undersheriff, the number two. That's Patty Cole Tyndall. Dow Constantine making that announcement yesterday morning.
Inside and outside of the sheriff's office, working with labor, serving our community, demonstrating integrity and transparency, really sort of uniquely position her to step into this role on January 1st and to be successful in it.
She has been with the county 6 years, a year and a half as the undersheriff. And before that, I believe she was the chief technology officer for about four and a half years. And in total, 30 years in various public service outside of the county prior to that. And is overall seen as a big key communicator. And that's something that she thinks will make a difference.
My passion and commitment for public service has always been centered on doing my best, being impeccable with my word, and being equitable in the treatment of all people. The Sheriff's Office has an opportunity during this transition to begin the process of bringing police and community together. We can build and repair trusting partnerships in an effort to achieve our common goal, improving safety for all people in King County.
And when she takes over on January 1st, she says she's not going to waste any time.
Within the Sheriff's Office, I plan on improving employee engagement through consistent and effective two-way communication. It is my belief that building trust with the community starts here at the top, and that shift will begin on day one.
But I did ask her a bit about the morale. I know just from my own coverage that there's been some morale issues within the King County Sheriff's Department, as we've seen somewhat at the Seattle Police Department. And here's what she said.
So in terms of what I will do, yeah, communication is really going to be key. But I also think engagement with our employees, right? My job, along with my team, will be to stabilize and to support our workforce and ensure the transition is smooth. There are a number of steps that I will be setting out over the next, you know, certainly by the first of the year, specific things. But what I would say now is communication will help, I think, to stabilize.
And there was one thing that was announced yesterday as a bit of surprise that definitely will help with morale, especially after a final vote was taken after this press conference.
To that end, I have asked County Council Budget Chair Jean Cole Wells to sponsor an emergency amendment for today's vote on the county budget that would, subject to ratification and with the respective unions, give a one-time $4,000 retention bonus to all commissioned sheriff's office employees in January.
So Dow Constantine announcing that he was, as you heard in the asking Jean Cole Wells to put that in the budget that they voted on yesterday, that did pass, and the hiring incentive did pass as well, and retention. So it was $4,000 for the existing commission officers, a $15,000 bonus for any lateral hires. Those are cops who come from other cop departments in the state, basically, or even out of the state, I think. And then $7,500 for new hires who have to start at the beginning and go through full police academy. And then additionally, $5,000 for existing commission officers who refer friends.
So that sounds like a morale booster. It also sounds like the King County Sheriff's Office is not embroiled in any kind of defunding issue.
No, and, you know, you heard a lot from Dow Constantine back when we were in the middle of the protests and things that, you know, he wanted to change a lot of the things that were going on in law enforcement. King County had a bad several years where there were multiple cases of very questionable incidents that ended up with a person of color, most of the time a black person who was dead, ended up in a lawsuit, and the county ended up paying out lots of dollars for that. Olio, the oversight agency that watches over what these things are within the department, had recommended multiple changes that were not implemented. Most people will say that, you know, Mitzi Jo Hagnett took over and there were these shootings and things that turned into lawsuits. Had most of them already happened prior to her being there. It just, you know, it landed on her. Some things could have been handled probably differently, a little bit more transparent, and that didn't happen. So the idea here now is to be very transparent while also reimagining a little bit the way they do law enforcement and making sure they have the right team to do that. And that includes having this new public safety work group that will inform some of the decisions and what that looks like. Dow was very clear that he doesn't know exactly what that looks like yet. It's a work in progress that will come when the permanent sheriff is selected. But he said that would include eventually a very robust conversations with all of the rank and file, having some input on what this is going to look like. So,
by the way, does the interim sheriff get to compete for the permanent job or not?
So I was going to tell you, she was asked yesterday, and she said she thought that would be a distraction. She feels that her contribution here, that this is an opportunity to share what she's learned with whoever does get that permanent position, and she said she will not be applying for it.
All right. Hannah Scott. Hannah, thank you.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Here is the mayor-elect of Seattle, Bruce Harrell. And Mr. Mayor-elect, we just got the new city council budget. I see that the people who proposed it are very happy about the amount of money spent on addressing homelessness. But it looks like a lot of this money also depends on the jumpstart tax surviving a court challenge. So where do you stand on that?
Well, I look forward to the revenue if, in fact, we do receive it and the litigation allows us to receive it. I have to tell you that I voiced some concerns as to whether the current council and their budget deliberations are still listening to the voters and listening to the people who really want strong and effective public safety. And I don't know if that is resonating with the council. And so I've expressed that opinion to them. You know, when you look at coming out of an election, Dave, you have to understand what people ran on and what the voters want. And it's very clear they want 7-minute response times. They want effective policing. And I'm not fully convinced that that was taken into consideration to the level that I would have liked it to have been. But, you know, I'm not going to make excuses coming in. I have to deal with the hand that I have.
What about the amount of money that's been devoted to addressing housing for unhoused people?
I did see some good investments there. I am concerned on how it appears they might have already decided the ARPA funds, the tranche of $116 million or so we will get from the federal government. I would like to have been in a position to have those discussions once my cabinet and I are in place. It's my understanding that there were some decisions made now, and we have not looked at that on a granular basis, but I would have liked more flexibility on how we handle those funds.
So overall, when you look at this budget, do you feel that you have the flexibility to basically fulfill your campaign promise, which, as I understand it, is that within a year, we're going to see a visible difference in homelessness in the city of Seattle?
So, Dave, that's a fair question and a good question. And I have to tell you, I am putting together my transition team and my transition plan. And so when I do not have access to all of the resources, and that by that I mean people, going over the budget line by line, is difficult for me to make that claim one way or the other. I've been weighing in. I've had volunteer members of my team weighing in. But it was just approved yesterday. So I cannot say, you know, I'm not getting into thumbs up or thumbs down. At some point, we articulated what we want. Our vision is clear. It's been clear for 8 months while I've run for office. And we'll see where we come out on it. But I'm not going to endorse it or criticize it. We just tried to articulate what we wanted. And now we have to see how we apply it.
I think you understand that when people hear yet again another politician saying, okay, I'm the one who's going to end homelessness. They've been hearing this for, well, I've been here. I'll tell you how long I've been hearing it. About 30 years, I think, it's fair to say. What makes your resolve to do this any different?
Well, first of all, I've never heard a politician or a mayor in recent years say that they will end homelessness. I haven't heard or seen a mayor say they own the problem. So you'd have to cite, you know, Dave, I am a lawyer. You have to cite to provide the citation there. What I have seen in City Hall as a general is always the excuse, well, we can't do it for this reason. We don't have enough resources for that. So I would respectfully disagree that I have not seen the kind of ownership that I'd like to see. And so to answer your question directly, I'm a candid person. I have a history of getting things done. I don't mince words. And so when I look at the resources we have, it's really about logistics, Dave. It's not about whether candidate A or candidate B, which one is more empathetic or which one has the more lived experience to relate to those that are experiencing homelessness. It's a question of logistics and strategy. And that's what I do. And that's what people around me will figure out. So what will make our approach different, I think, is just a straight talk the strategy to look at what we have to build. And I said, we can build and treat our way out of the problem. So again, I don't know the other approach, the approaches or the rhetoric coming from other mayors. I just know what we are going to do. And it's quite frankly, as simple as that.
Mm-hmm. But what you're saying is you own this. So you're saying that if in a year we don't see a difference, you're not going to blame the council. You're not going to blame the Downtown Seattle Association or whoever else. It's on you.
Well, I don't blame. I have a lifetime of not blaming anyone. What I tell particular people who are not experiencing what they want, that the moment you start blaming others, you are conceding power and conceding that with which you can control. And so that's never been my approach in life. And so I will not blame anyone for anything that anything we could have done better. At the end of the day, we will devote an inordinate amount of time and resources and strategy and deep thinking towards solving this issue, which is homelessness. And we will not be held hostage to the political rhetoric that we see. We will lead with integrity and conviction. So I'm confident that's why people elected me. I said the same thing for 8 months, but I've said the same thing my entire life, that if you just look at my personal story, I accomplished that which I set out to do. So we will be aggressive, we will be smart, and we will lead with kindness. And so I'm trying to change the narrative in this city.
But I get it.
You understand that.
Leading with kindness is something that people, I think, appreciate hearing. But, I mean, you the council controls the purse strings. Okay, so let me ask you this. Do you feel you can work with this current council, or since there's a recall election coming up, would you be able to work better with a council that does not have Shama Selwant on it?
So, Dave, I thought I had the primer. These are supposed to be lob easy softball questions. And
yeah, that's my reputation, I know.
So, let the voters decide, right? And the way I look at it is I have criticized the city council, absolutely, the current one. Not them as a human beings. They're outstanding human beings. It is not that issue. Their policies are misaligned, I believe, with what the city wants. And so I've actively said I'm looking for city council members to run instead of other people to run. That, everyone has an opinion. But these people on the council, they worked hard to put themselves in this position. So if one is critical, as they are, then get off the bench and see what you can do if you can do it better. So I'm not wasting my time criticizing them as a council. I just, again, think there is a misalignment. And I said that publicly. It's no big secret. So whether she's recalled or not, I will deal with the hand that I'm dealt.
Seattle's mayor-elect, Bruce Harrell. Good luck and thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. An organization is teaching girls how to set and achieve personal goals, improving not only their health, but their self-esteem and happiness. CBS's Nora O'Donnell has the story.
Girls on the Run, a nationwide program empowering 8 to 13-year-olds.
Hi, girls. I'm Nora.
I met up with the D.C. team last week.
I am the girl that's going to run.
I am the girl that's going to run.
They're taught they can accomplish anything, even crushing a cold morning run.
I love it. You guys are fast.
We find that girls at the age of 9 begin to lose their confidence. We find that by age 10, they start to become less physically active.
The program has gone the distance. In its 25 years, it served more than 2 million girls.
Who loves running?
Yay! Ada, what are you learning from Girls on the Run?
I'm learning to never give up and to always keep trying.
And if empowering young girls isn't enough, each team does a community service project, like writing letters to children's hospitals.
What's a word that starts with E?
Extraordinary!
Wow!
Yeah. That's awesome!
What makes you keep going?
My friends cheering me on and saying, you can do this.
The Girls on the Run has helped me so much that I feel like nothing is in my way of winning that race.
There are some local chapters of this organization here, too. I was in contact with the Snohomish County one over the summer. It is a phenomenal program, especially since they intertwine athletics with community service projects, just really building up these girls.
Good idea. This is Seattle's Morning News, and if you are headed to Europe, you need to know that some countries are actually thinking about locking things down again. Cairo's Nicole Jennings is just back from a trip to Europe, and so where did you go exactly, Nicole?
I was in Germany and Austria visiting. I have a lot of relatives and friends there. I lived there a couple of different times in my life. So I was there visiting family and friends. Then I was in England a few days before flying home via London.
We were hearing about the demonstrations in the Netherlands, in Germany. There was one in Brussels. Did you encounter anything like that?
I didn't. What I encountered, really, and maybe it was because I was in cities and not in the rural areas, which, like here, kind of tend to be more anti-COVID measures. What I encountered was really widespread compliance.
The demonstrations, of course, were because some countries, or at least some areas of some countries, feel they have to lock down again because they're seeing a resurgence of cases. So were people taking the rules seriously where you were?
Yes, from what I saw. And actually, I mean, the rules, it was so much stronger than here at home. And to be honest, I personally felt a lot safer being out in public because of that. So we saw right away in Germany and Austria, at least, saw right away that no matter what, as soon as you sat down in a restaurant or a cafe or a bar or went into any sort of recreation facility, whether it be a gym or a museum or a theater, anything like that, the vaccine card came out. You had to show either that you were vaccinated or... So what Germany had was what they call 3G, which means 3G. It's geimpft, genesen, or getested. So what that meant is that you had to show that you were vaccinated, that you'd had a recent test, or that you had recovered from COVID-19. Austria changed that a little bit while we were there as cases started ramping up to 2G, which just meant that you had to show that you were vaccinated or recovered. A test wouldn't work anymore. And so while we were in Austria, a lot of people started rushing out to get vaccines, because they realized they weren't able to use that testing loophole anymore. But in general, just about everyone at restaurants and things, it seemed to be that they were showing on their phone the vaccine QR code that they had. One other rule that changed while I was there in Bavaria specifically, again, as cases started going up, was that you had to have a KN95 style mask to go into a store or anything. Yeah, and that wasn't just to go into the places where you would sit down. That was to go anywhere, to get takeout, to go shopping, no matter what. The first day that that went into effect, I saw a woman just in a drugstore chain who walked in a surgical mask, and she was asked to leave. So
really, I was going to ask you how they enforce it. So in other words, it's not just that you have a mask on, but you have to have a certain, you have to have the top line mask, the 95 and 95.
The knockoffs, you know, those were fine. I bought a pack of three of them.
Yes, K stands for knockoff. I realize that. But but apparently it does have the approval of the CDC.
Yeah, just that they wanted those kind, that the, you know, the kind of the heavy duty white ones rather than the surgical ones or the cloth ones.
And the approach was, when you saw this enforced, they said that mask doesn't qualify, you'll need to leave, and the person didn't try to throw a punch, they just complied, huh?
Yeah. I guess she could have bought one right there. She was right at the counter at the drugstore, or she could have. But in her case, she walked out.
Yeah. Okay. And you felt safer. So that's interesting to me. And no demonstrations. Now, what about the whole travel experience? Because you had to go through, I'm sure, some long lines in crowded airports.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's definitely, you want to be on your guard in airports and try to avoid standing too close to people and everything. But in general, it was the same thing. You know, masking was enforced. I mean, you can't even get on a plane to Europe without showing that you're vaccinated. And you have to upload all of your documents to different sites and things. And we got tested a few different times. So, you know, in general, just because of all the precautions being enforced so well, I really did feel safe traveling. I will say the one exception to this was the UK.
Really?
Masking was not nearly as enforced in the UK as in Germany and Austria. I was never asked for my vaccine card. And even though places like public transport, like the London Tube, you were supposed to wear masks, I would say about half the people didn't. And I was surprised by that. I thought the UK would take it a little more seriously.
Yeah. So you said you were tested?
getting a home test in Germany is easy and cheap. Certainly not like here where, you know, I've had to drive 30 miles before to get a test. I had a little cold over there that my cousin gave me as a souvenir, and I just wanted to make sure it wasn't COVID. And, you know, just went to the corner bakery, got a home test for €2. Within 15 minutes, I had results. It was easy.
They sell tests at the bakery?
Yes, at the bakery. You can get a pastry and you can get a test.
And it only takes 2 minutes, you said?
No, €2, and it took about 15 minutes.
€2 and 15 minutes. Okay. Mm-hmm. I thought it was €15 and 2 minutes. Okay. And then does it give you some kind of a piece of litmus paper you can show to people to prove that you took the test, or how do you prove that you passed?
Well, in this case, those kind wouldn't be accepted for travel or something like that. You would still want to go get a PCR test or something, but it's more the peace of mind test that if you test negative like I did, then you're okay. If you test positive, you probably want to reconfirm that. It could be a false positive, but it's more just to see whether or not you need to take another step. In my case, I was negative, so I didn't go any further with it. Basically, it was kind of like an at-home pregnancy test or something.
Yeah,
it really was a little strip of paper.
I'd have gotten a lot of tests because I just love those German bakeries. It's been a long time since I've been to Germany, but every city we stopped, this was during a Glee Club trip during college, and every time we stopped in a new city, first place I went was the Bäckerei and got some kind of chocolate thing. And now you can get a chocolate thing and a test to go with it.
You can stay healthy from COVID, but I don't know how healthy I was on eating.
Yeah, I know. Deadly. It's deadly. Kyria's Nicole Jennings. Thanks, Nicole.
Thank you.
And don't let the fanfare fool you, because this is not a joyous occasion. Not for us. But it is a joyous occasion for award-winning Cairo film critic and beloved, dare I say, legendary talk show host Tom Tangney, who after 27 years at Cairo Radio, 27 years, you call that a career, is retiring.
How is it, Dave, that I'm retiring before you?
The very
that
question makes... I asked, Mr. Tangney.
It was his plan. It was his plan all along.
Is that right? You're going to outweigh every one of us. And Ursula's probably next. Dory, it's like, what has gotten into you?
I don't know, but this is about you.
Oh, it is.
So
okay.
You've decided to retire, and I wanted to be able to talk to you one last time because, as you know, I discovered you. And
a lot of people have made that claim, but still, Dave, I give you a lot of credit. I still remember. So I was doing movie reviews at that point, but I had never been on talk shows of much note. And you brought me on because you had seen Finding Nemo and were outraged that people were making fun of the overprotective father. And you wanted to run that thesis by me.
Right.
And I was so charmed by your naivete, Dave, that I launched it. It was the start. And I remember, I think it was Greg Herschel back in the day said something, but man, Tom, you really sound good just, you know, talking extemporaneously. Yeah. And I think that was one of my many launches, Dave, and I credit you.
Yes. And you also allowed me eventually to invent the Tang. So that we could rate movies, you forbid it for the longest time. You,
that's right.
Because being the effete intellectual snob that you are, you thought that it was just really...
Reductive.
Reductive. That's the word I was searching for. Reductive to rate movies based on a crude scale that allowed for no subtlety. But eventually you did allow it, and so I'm
that's
very
right.
happy
any,
for that.
Any critic worth his salt will tell you that. They hate the star system because then no one pays attention to what you have to say about the movie. They only look at, well, did he like it or didn't he like it? And we're not just a consumer guide service. I want to talk about the movie and explain and discuss the movie, and the star system reduced it. However, and this is what won me over, Dave, the more I thought about it, first off, it's an honor to be considered in any way, you know, a Dave Ross creation. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, speaking of legendary, if I'm a legend, I don't know what you are, a mythos of your own universe. But the thing is also, you brilliantly, and this is what makes you so good at what you do, you brilliantly reduced or enlarged the star system to sound, which is the essence of radio. And from that point of view, when I think of it as a sound effect and not just a star system, then I'm honored to be tanged by Dave.
I give that comment 5 times.
All right.
There we go.
Something's off there, Dave.
Yeah, you're right. Something is off. I'm really sorry because now I have to retire that sound effect forever, and it took a long time.
to work that together.
Right. Sure. Tell us a story we've never heard before from your career. I'm trying to sound like a little kid that wants to hear a good story.
That's good. From my career, oh my God, that's just that's a question you should have prompted me on, and I could have thought about it. Something you've never heard. Well, there are all sorts. You know, one thing, I'm not going to tell this story, but there are a lot of things about working with John Curley that are amazing, and they are intended and meant to be kept private. Yeah. But it is, working with a whirling dervish like John Curley is an amazing experience. I would say about 90% of it is a fantastic experience and 10% of it isn't. But there are just so many, the crucible of putting on a talk show with somebody as improvisational as John Curley is really a work of art. I mean, I really think it's stunning. I've loved my last 8 years with John. Even when I hated the last parts of the last 8 years with John, it was exhilarating nonetheless.
Tom, so, I got to jump in here because I know we're running out of time. I'm going to miss the heck out of you, because it's so much. You and I have had so many discussions over the years,
right,
off air, and for such an intellectual person that I always make fun of, your passion for sports and especially football, college football, have, you know, it's just such an interesting juxtaposition that that's the refuge that you go into. And I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up the Apple Cup and everything that's going on with the Huskies this week, because we haven't had a chance to talk college football in forever. Now I'm not going to do it anymore.
That's right.
Call them up, man.
That's right. I'm not dying. That's the good news of this. I'm just leaving the station. And I'm not leaving. I just want to make sure people know. Usually when people leave the station, you know, there's all these rumblings. Oh, gee, did he not get along with this? Or is he mad about this policy? I've loved every second of working at Cairo Radio. And I'm not leaving because I'm not happy. I'm very happy. And if I could be guaranteed that I was going to have another 25 healthy years in me, I'm already 67. I would gladly work another 5-7 years at Cairo. I am not leaving Cairo because Cairo isn't great or isn't a fantastic job. It's because I have so many other things that I want to get around to doing, and I don't know how much time I have left, so I want to try other things. I'd said this before, if I'd always thought I was going to be a college prof, and if I had been a college prof for like the last 27 years, and then somebody said, hey, Tom, what, you want to try radio? I'd go, heck yes, that sounds like a lot of fun. I just want to try something different.
So you're going to become a professor finally? You're going to finish your doctorate?
That's right.
You're going to write the dissertation finally?
I think all my advisors have passed on.
That's the best kind of advisor to have.
My dissertation, when I was writing my dissertation about postmodernist art and its relationship to postmodernist literature.
Yes.
The thing is, they were all cutting edge people. Now they're all part of history. I was on the cutting edge of things back, you know, 35 years ago. Now they're all sort of historical figures.
You can write it on postmodernist art now.
Yes, that's true. The post-pop movement.
One thing I do want to say before we run out of time, because I don't know if I'm going to see you before this is all over, right, is just, you know, thank you for your advocacy and belief in the news product at Cairo Radio.
Oh, my God.
And always being on the side of news.
Absolutely.
It's so important as newsroom shrink, and you are a fearless protector of news and journalism, and I love to see it.
That is really true. You know, my overarching thing, if I've been there for 30 years, I spent 20 years working the news department and the news desk and all of that, and 10 doing talk shows, and talk shows are a lot of fun. But I am concerned, just as a general kind of overview, I'm concerned about the outsized influence that talk show hosts like me can have on the news product. And I really think that we need to bolster the news department, and so I'm really glad that you gave me a chance to reference that. Yes. Okay. Talk shows are all great, but they need to have a basis in the news to make it work, and the news function of Cairo Radio is still super important to me.
I'm still not going to that press conference you assigned me to when you were working at the desk.
I know. That. It's a good thing you're in traffic. I can't tell you where to go now.
Well, I will miss you too, and especially because I could walk into the newsroom and talk about the opera I went to last night, and you wouldn't roll your eyes.
Yes! I know. It was so great. The only time I'd roll my eyes at you, Dave, when it came to musical productions was Gil Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yes, I know.
But the opera, the opera was safe. In fact, I still, here's a, one little story I love. Not long after Dave was put back into the early morning slot, and suddenly I was working the 9 to noon slot, which used to be the Dave Ross slot, I ran into him at the opera, and I said, you know, Dave, as I'm, because I used to do the early morning show, as I'm getting up, you know, about 7 o'clock, and I turn on the radio, and I hear you there, I realize that you got up at 3:30 to get there, and I'm thinking, at you're probably going through my mind, what did I do wrong in my career? I have been here forever, have done everything, been successful at everything. How is it that I'm the one getting up at 4 in the morning, and Tom Tangney gets to loaf in at 9 o'clock for yeah. his show, which used to be my slot?
Yeah, exactly. But I've learned to live with it.
Apparently you have, and you're doing a bang-up job, you and Colleen and Chris and all of you guys.
Best
it's
of
fantastic
luck.
Work.
Have a great time.
Yes, I'm going to try real hard.
All right, Tom. Oh, boy.
Thanks,
France,
you guys.
Thanks,
yeah,
big
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.